the director's report, a little bit behind schedule, but we'll make it up at some point. Director Anderson.
Thank you. I might be able to help you make a little bit of that up, because we were able to discuss a couple of the topics that I had on my list of things to bring to the commission's attention already this morning as a part of the public comment piece. I have a list of 10 or so things I want to touch on here, and some which will be pretty quick, but important topics that I wanted you to be aware of. The first one is Joby Shimomura is the new governor's chief of staff. She's been in place, I think, at least a couple months or so. And I had an opportunity to go over and introduce myself to her earlier this week. And we had a great conversation. And we talked about how to improve and enhance the communications and linkages between WDFW and the governor's office. While we didn't reach any conclusions on exactly how we were going to do that, we did discuss the potential of forming a natural resources sub-cabinet, because we have several different natural resource agencies, including Department of Natural Resources, State Parks, as well as ourselves, whereby in the case of Parks and the Department of Fish and Wildlife, were appointed by commissions, and so we're not appointed by the governor, and as a result, we haven't been regular participants in the cabinet. And having three of the major natural resource agencies be in kind of that category, you know, I expressed a concern that there's been some loss of touch with between the agencies and the governor's office, so it was a great meeting and very encouraging. And so we're going to continue. I might point out we've certainly had a strong working relationship with the governor's natural resource policy folks, and particularly Keith Phillips and JT Austin have been great to work with. And so we look at building on that and expanding it. Just wanted to change in gears here, going to federal budget update. I provided as part of the director's report the last two meetings, November and December, some ringing of some alarm bells relative to the potential cuts that we saw coming in a number of programs that are really important to the Department of Fish and Wildlife that receive federal funding. I think everybody's aware that the Bipartisan Budget Act that was signed into law by President Obama on December 26th set some new discretionary spending caps for fiscal year 14 and 15. We don't have definitive numbers that came out of that or are going to come out of that because the appropriations haven't been made yet. But if it just in general, it looks like the cuts have been roughly cut in half from what the kind of the worst case scenario was that I presented in November and December for 14. The reductions in the discretionary spending for 15 are a little bit less, so go from $43 billion down to $20 billion in 15. So that's roughly about a quarter, a reduction of about 25% of what we were looking at in 2015. So again, we need to wait for the appropriations to be made, particularly to NOAA Fisheries, and to find out exactly how that's going to shake out. And that's on the discretionary side. On the mandatory side, there's going to be continued an estimated 7.5% reduction to those mandatory funds. So those affect Dingell Johnson funds that we use for funding hatchery production, monitoring and sampling of fisheries. Also, the coastal wetland restoration funds will be impacted by that, as well as Pittman-Roberts. And for the DJ account, in addition to that 7.5% reduction, we're also preparing for a reduction that's as a result of lower revenues coming into the DJ account. So there's kind of two hits there that are yet to be known with certainty, but we're preparing for a reduction somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 million added in DJ monies. Fish program is in the process of conducting an analysis of potential options that could result from those cuts and the compounding budget impacts when we get to 15. I have invited a group of about 16 or 17 of our stakeholders to come in and meet with me and other department staff here later this month, so that we can make sure everybody has an understanding of kind of what we're looking at, both from a federal budget perspective as well as a state budget perspective. And with and when I say state, I'm in particular talking about our wildlife account, so that we can see if we can get a coalition approach to trying to address and counteract some of the these pretty significant reductions that appear to be on the horizon. So although the picture is better than as a result of the Bipartisan Budget Act, it's we're still far from out of the woods and have some real challenges in front of us from a budget perspective.
Thanks.
And as many of you know, particularly those on the Fish Committee, we've been involved in an issue dealing with Bonneville Power Administration, use of mitigation dollars for the purpose of coated wire tagging, the potential reduction of funding coming from BPA for coated wire tagging and sampling and monitoring of fisheries that in combination with the cuts that were originally being discussed that would affect Oregon, were approaching dollar amounts of $2.5 million. When that news, when we were given that news back in October 2013, we began trying to look at ways to deal with that. So there's been a large engagement, not only from us, but this issue's also been up in front of the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. So working with Phil Rockefeller, Tom Carrier, who are council members from Washington, and a number of stakeholders who also have a significant interest in this issue. All of that resulted in a meeting that we had with Bonneville Power Administration, Governor's Office, Power Council representatives, as well as ourselves here this week on Monday. There's been some additional conversations between the Governor's Natural Resource Policy lead on this, who's J.T. Austin, and Lori Bodie from Bonneville Power Administration last night. And what we have on the table right now is a one-year realignment of funds from Mitchell Act fund source that have been used for screening and passage, and in the amount of $171,000. That work would be picked up by BPA, and conversely, the coated wire tag piece would be with the same amount would be picked up by Mitchell Act. So that's where we ended up for this year, emphasizing that it was a one-year piece. We also basically have three elements that I'm hoping we come out of this with. One is that there's the issue about the supplemental biological opinion and whether or not Washington is going to take a similar strong stand in defending the elements of that supplemental biological opinion as we did previously. The piece about ensuring that the reasonable and prudent alternatives that are part of the biological opinion, which include things like coated wire tag, sampling, monitoring, alternative gear development, all of those pieces that there is a commitment to continue to fund those activities, and if there is any desire to look at potential reprioritization or fund shifts, that there is an absolute guarantee that there's a backstop so that those activities continue to get funded fully. And then the last piece was ensuring that if they are, if BPA is going to consider any kind of a proposal of that kind, that that gets communicated and discussed at a senior policy level with us, with the Power Council, with the Governor's Office, so we're not learning about those types of initiatives at staff levels with contract officers and those at that those levels within the agency that this occurred. So we had what I thought was a very productive and candid conversation with Bonneville Power Administration, with those other participants there. The Governor's Office has been great coordinating with us, as has the Power Council, and our two council members have been just fantastic to work with on this issue. So there is a meeting that the Governor will have with BPA leadership, I think on, I want to say it's on January 16th. I'd have to look at a calendar to make sure that's the right date, but it's coming up here shortly. The purpose of the discussion last night was to ensure that we have consensus on the message and what the state will be looking for as a way to move forward with BPA when the Governor talks with their senior leadership. As I mentioned during our discussion under public comment on tribal hunting issues, we had received Department of Natural Resources, Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Governor's Office had received a request for a government-to-government meeting with the Skokomish tribal leaders. Department of Natural Resources, Commissioner Goldmark elected to have a separate government-to-government meeting with the tribe, and he did that, I think it was on December 10th or along, right in there. I wanted to have that government-to-government meeting with the Governor's Office representative, so J.T. Austin and myself went out and met with Skokomish tribal leadership this week. Forgetting which day, Tuesday, I think, and discussed some of the issues that were being raised here today by the Quileute tribe relative to the agreements with three of the other tribes. And we also discussed the jurisdictional issue that you may recall that we had with the Skokomish tribe on the river adjacent to the reservation. And that had to do with whether or not a state license was all that was required to fish on the river in that portion of the river that's adjacent to the reservation, or whether a tribal permit was also required. And so we had a pretty good conversation about that. More to come on that. But all in all, we had a productive discussion. And I frankly learned some things from the Skokomish tribal leadership in terms of their concerns that I hadn't recognized before. So it was a good chance to talk with them. The next piece is the International Pacific Halibut Commission, set up by the treaty between the United States and Canada to manage the halibut resource. There are three commissioners from the United States and obviously three from Canada. We just recently, their annual meeting is next week. We just had two new commissioners appointed by the president representing the United States on the commission, and one of those individuals is a person by the name of Don Lane. He's from Homer, Alaska. I've met him. I've been impressed by him, so I think he's going to be a good addition. And the other individual was a longtime associate colleague, Bob Alverson, was appointed. His dad made him famous, but Lee Alverson is certainly a huge name in the fishery management world. And Bob has represented the Fishing Vessel Owners Association for, I think, probably somewhere over 30 years, and has been very active in the halibut arena for a long time, as well as the North Pacific Council. And he was a council member, one of Washington's council members on the Pacific Fishery Management Council. So I'm delighted that Bob got the appointment. I had a chance to talk to him yesterday and congratulate him and talk a little bit about the meeting that's coming up. Regarding the halibut meeting coming up, just I don't think I brought those notes, but last year my memory is that we have a coastwide allowable catch, which last year I believe was 31.7 million pounds, so that includes everything from out in the Aleutians through the Gulf, Canada, and we call our area Area 2A, which is everything south of the U.S.-Canada border. The staff is recommending the overall removals be reduced from that 31 million pound level down to 24 million and some change. There's also an apportionment calculation that they make, and this year they expanded the survey area for Area 2A down into Northern California, and as a result that increased the proportion of the allowable catch that was allotted to Area 2A from 2% up to 2.4%. So that'll help. At the same time, with the staff recommendations for Area 2A, it would have our quota going down from something close to a million pounds. It's in the 900s. Don't remember the exact number, but down to somewhere around 730,000 pounds. So a pretty significant reduction. In Area 2A, we've been seeing an increase in our catch per unit of effort, though, and we're pretty concerned that what's happening in the stock up in the Gulf, we're not seeing that same kind of reduction down in the southern end of the population, and so we have two people going to the meeting next week. The tribe certainly have a lot of folks that will be attending the Halibut Commission meeting next week, and so we have a kind of a 2A coalition that includes Oregon and Washington and tribes, and we have California now too. So we'll see how that comes out, but that kind of gives you kind of a sense of what's coming there. Another piece is you may recall, for those of you who are here when I talked about this, is we have a U.S.-Canada treaty relative to albacore. It's been in place since the mid-90s. It has a component of it that's a reciprocal fishing regime whereby U.S. vessels are allowed to access Canadians' exclusive economic zone, which is what we call EEZ, everything from 3 to 200 miles. And conversely, we have allowed a segment of the Canadian fleet to access the U.S. EEZ. And that the number of vessels that we, under the previous reciprocal agreement, was that about 107 Canadian vessels were allowed to come into the U.S. EEZ. That number of vessels created some crowding issues on the grounds. The Canadian fleet, in terms of the average size of vessel, has grown somewhat. As a result, we didn't have as much of the Canadian catch taken in the U.S. EEZ coming into U.S. ports. So the benefits from having the reciprocal agreement were less than they were when the agreement was negotiated. The U.S. fishing, or the West Coast albacore fleet, which is made up of primarily two major organizations, coalesced around a position that was opposed to any kind of a renewal of a reciprocal fishing agreement. In So in 2012, talks broke down between the two countries. There wasn't any kind of a reciprocal agreement. There were certainly concerns on the part of those of us who, the states, and particularly Washington, has a close working relationship with British Columbia about the impacts to some of our relationships and other issues as a result of that. The State Department negotiated for 2013 a one-year agreement that allowed somewhere around 47 vessels or so instead of the 107, but it was a one-year deal. So the State Department representative whose name is David Hogan, is going to have a meeting with the Canadians on the 21st of January. It's not a negotiating session. It's an exchange of views. It's also intended to, because we've certainly sent the signal to the Canadians that it's our desire to phase out the reciprocal fishing arrangement over a relatively short number of years. So reinforcing that perspective. The Pacific Council, State of Washington, the fishing organizations, both processors and the harvesters, all have representatives that are advising David Hogan, and we've been a part of that and will continue to be. We're not planning to go to this meeting. It's up in Vancouver, and it's a one-day meeting, and there's too many other competing things going on, but we are going to be tracking that issue closely, and I just wanted you to be aware of it. Another piece is the Magnuson-Stevens Act. So the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation Management Act, it's the one that was passed by Congress in 1976, set up the eight regional councils. We participate on two of them, the North Pacific Council, which has developed fishery management plans for the waters from 300 to 200 miles off Alaska, and then the Pacific Fishery Management Council, which has management plans for the waters from 300 to 200 miles off Washington and California. That act is up for reauthorization. Congressman Hastings has released a discussion draft. Hastings called attention to his draft as being one that gives regional fishery managers increased flexibility, provides increased economic stability and certainty to fishermen and fishery-dependent communities. These are my words, astonishing part is that it would prohibit the New England, the Mid-Atlantic, the South Atlantic, and the Gulf of Mexico councils from submitting fishery management plans to NOAA for approval unless the majority of permit holders had approved it. So it's astonishing to me, but at any rate, I'm sure that'll get a lot of attention. As I said, the last update of this was truly a bipartisan agreement that was done in 2006. It emphasized the reliance on sound science, robust rebuilding requirements for overfished stocks. We do expect to see a Senate bill, and Senator Cantwell has sent some recent signals to us about the possibility of holding a hearing focused on West Coast issues, but the hearing would be held in Washington, D.C., maybe during the last week of January. Haven't set the date yet, but we're expecting to be invited to testify at that hearing, so we're watching that closely. So getting away from fish and back to some fur, talked a little bit about wolves. So we're finalizing our winter surveys. They've been conducted in the Salmo, Diamond, Smackout, Ruby, Lookout, Wedge, and Tianaway packs. Tribal biologist Colville in particular surveying, as well as I believe the Spokane tribe is also doing some surveying, Strawberry, the Nisiasin, and the, I know I didn't pronounce that right, and the that's the one on the Colville Res, and Huckleberry Packs. There's tribal biologists who are engaged in those. We've also are in the process of confirming some new pack activity in northeastern Washington. We also received reports about the potential of having a pack in the Blue Mountains area in southeast. After comparing our location and sighting descriptions with recent locations of the Oregon's Wenaha pack, we confirmed that pack had made a foray into Washington similar to the time that they did last year. So we're not thinking we have a new pack there, but we just think that pack is, as it has done before, is coming into the southeast part of the state, into Commissioner Hosemiller's backyard. New packs, pack size, number of successful breeding pairs, that information is going to be presented to the commission at your February meeting. We've also got winter helicopter captures. They're expected to begin in February. They'll focus on the Diamond, Smackout, Ruby, Salmo, Huckleberry, Tianaway, and Lookout packs, and the goal is to try to get 2 to 3 callers on in each pack. I mean, that's a tall order, but that's the goal. The Wolf Advisory Group has also been active. They met back on December 19th. They're continuing their discussions about the potential recommendation for codifying portions of the Wolf Conservation Management Plan, looking at protocols for lethal control of problem wolves, and the revision process of the Game Management Plan. I know we had testimony about that here during the open public comment. We did send a letter that was under Chair Wecker's and my signature to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service supporting their proposal to delist gray wolves in western Washington or the remainder of Washington. We've had two new conflict issues arise here recently. One is that we had the reports of a wolf biting a dog up in Ponderay County. We had our conflict specialist, Jay Shepard, and Officer Erickson responded and confirmed that the English bulldog had in fact been bitten by a wolf. My understanding, the information I have, is the dog survived and is healing. So, lucky dog. One that we've had a lot more activity on here in the last week or so is that we've received reports of a wolf repeatedly visiting a ranch north of Ellensburg. The report was that the wolf was scavenging in an area where there were discarded cattle bones. It was playing with the rancher's dog and hanging around the ranch and people during the day. The animal has regularly visited the site over the last month. Obviously, this type of habituated behavior does occasionally occur when wolves are dispersed throughout the range. The ranch is in an area where wolves are federally listed. We've been in consultations with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. There's been some unsuccessful attempts to trap the animal. So we're continuing our consultations with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, primarily looking to them to take the lead with our support as appropriate, given that it's in the federally listed area.
Dr. Anderson?
Yes.
We had a Wildlife Committee meeting this morning, and one of the points that Nate Pamplin made was that you've brought on board 11 new staff to handle a lot of this additional workload. And not only is that a wonderful fact, but they also are superbly experienced people. He was very enthusiastic about all the help we are getting now, and the fact that their experience brings a lot of information from the previous states to have dealt with wolf issues. So.
Yeah, we've really been fortunate to attract some really great staff members. And, you know, as you know, as we the wildlife conflict piece as we transfer that responsibility from enforcement to the wildlife program. The influx of Pittman Roberts funding put us in a position where we were able to put a significant amount of new resources toward addressing not only wolf kinds of issues, but also just wildlife conflict issues. We certainly have one up in Skagit Valley with elk, and we've got a new specialist on our team up there. So it's been a great add. I did just want to briefly mention, as you did, Chair Wecker, about this really outstanding work that our enforcement team did in dealing with and uncovering a number of different illegal activities that are impacting Puget Sound Dungeness crab. They did serve search warrants on January 6th in three counties, Snohomish, King, and Whatcom County. I think the three primary areas where they found some significant issues is, number one, harvesting and retention of undersized crab, and those crab then showing up in the marketplace. The failure to record landed catch through fish receiving tickets, and the buying and selling without a license. So there was a lot of enforcement resources, as you probably are aware, devoted to that activity. I think we had 14 officers involved on January 6th, the day that those search warrants were served. It was a culmination of a long bit of work that had been done. It's far from over. I mean, they're just, you know, through the exercising the search warrants, gaining new information that they need to look at and analyze and assess and see where that might lead them. So there's a lot of more work to come, but just a really an outstanding effort, and the coordination that we had with the Lummi Tribal Police also was certainly notable, as you mentioned. I also wanted to just make you aware, as I think many of you are at least, that Ron Warren has taken on a new position within the fish program. We've added a deputy assistant director position to try to help with the policy workload within the fish program, everything from North Falcon working with tribes, other types of intergovernmental work, and there's, in addition to that, Ron has the section dealing with salmon management. That crew that's within the fish program is going to be reporting through him. So we're trying to bring some additional resources to that, as well as help transition as we have some experienced staff potentially moving out as they reach retirement age. We were trying to make sure if we can build a bench and a foundation before those retirements occur, that we'll be in a better position to carry on without a letdown. Also, Steve Teasfield, which some of you may know, he's been a real active part of our North Falcon team and Puget Sound Managed Salmon Management Team, was selected as the new Regional Program Manager for Region 6 in Montesano. So really excited about that. I'm excited for Steve because he has just grown tremendously over the time that I've been around him, which has been a while, and I'm just really excited to see him. It's a darn difficult job, as we all know. But I'm really excited that he's got some really good qualities to bring to that, following in Ron's footsteps there in that position. Lastly, just some upcoming pieces. I've got a Pacific Salmon Commission meeting starting on Monday morning down in Portland next week that I will be attending from Monday through Thursday. I mentioned the Halibut Commission meeting next week. Michelle Culver and Heather Reed will be there. Our 2014 legislative session starts next week, so a lot of activity. Ann Larson and other staff members that are with her advancing our legislative agenda. Had an opportunity to meet or to meet with or see a number of legislators here since the first of the year. So I think we're well positioned to be successful, I hope. Also, we backed away for budget reasons from participating in a number of the sports shows, and we reevaluated that and have we participated in a number last year. We collected some data, looked at staff time versus contacts and some of those kinds of things, and have got a what I think is a really good plan for this coming year, and we're just about to start that. We have the Tri-City Sportsman Show that we'll be at January 17th through the 19th. We've got the Washington Sportsman Show, which is in Puyallup, 22nd through the 26th. The Pacific Northwest Sportsman Show is in Portland, first week of February, 5th through the 9th. Then to Yakima, which is the Central Washington Sportsman Show, that's February 14th through the 16th. Wenatchee Valley Sportsman Show, the 21st through the 23rd in February. And finally, the Bighorn Outdoor Adventure Show, which is in Spokane, March 20th through the 23rd. So we've got, we've really worked on coordinating across the agency so that we can do a really good job and have consistent messages, as well as make sure we've got knowledgeable folks that will be at those shows. So we're looking forward to that. And then I just wrote down the 2014 North of Falcon process is about to get underway. It's coming at us fast, so there's a lot of organizational things being done internally to get ready for that. And when Ron speaks with you about the North Falcon policy, we'll have a chance a little bit to bring folks up to speed as to some follow-up to the co-management meeting that we had with the tribes back in the early part of October. And I know Joe's got a couple of things to add, but that's what I have to provide you today.
Okay. Thank you. Deputy Director Storr?
Let's see if I can do this. Good morning, Commissioners. I want to just give you a quick look at the budget situation. The governor's budget came out after our last meeting together, and what you have in front of you now is I put together a memo that describes in some detail that budget, and I won't go through all of that, but I wanted to, especially for the new commission members, also just give you a look at the various accounts that we have and how complicated our budget actually is. So this will just take a minute, maybe five. So this is a supplemental session. This is the short session, and budget really is supposed to focus on emergent issues or emergencies, new things that have arisen since the long session, the budget session last year. This is the first of four budgets that we'll see as we go through the session. The governor's budget comes out shortly before the session begins, which, as the director said, is Monday. And then about mid-February, late February, we'll see a House budget, a Senate budget, and then hopefully a final compromise between the three parties by the end of the session. As you know, that's typical, and the last several sessions haven't been typical because of budget pressures, but that's the expectation as of today. The revenue forecast looks slightly positive, which is different than we've had for the last 5 years. That's good news. Caseload, the drivers on the use of general fund, medical costs, institutions, corrections, those are still going up and will be tough. And then on top of that, I think most of you have heard about the McCleary decision, which is bringing lots of legal attention to funding for K-12 education. So those challenges are still out there. General fund is still scarce. Having said that, the governor chose to accept nearly all of our proposals, which is unusual. I mean, we had a couple that were partially funded, and I detail those in the memo here. And even better news, didn't cut any of our staff or any of our activities. So we actually came out, our budget actually grew from $376 million for the 2 years to $380 million. That's our operating budget. When we talk about operating budget, it's broken into two levels, and I've identified those here. The maintenance level part of the budget is that which covers our committed costs. Laws that have been passed or decisions that have been made by the legislature, those costs usually don't get a lot of attention and are included in the maintenance level. And then there's the second level is the performance level, where new policy initiatives are funded. In our maintenance level budget, we received $2.8 million of general fund. Even with all the pressure for fire suppression costs, that was good news. In our performance level, we received an additional $1.4 million for staff and work necessary to deal with the culvert case, the fish passage barrier issue. So that was also good news. In addition, in the performance level, we received $200,000 for hoof rot exploration, one time. So that'll help us with the Southwest Washington discussion. Two of our primary legislative bills, the Aquatic Invasive Species Bill, did not receive the funding we requested. There's still a lot of concern about new fees. As I said, general fund is short, but the policy portion of that bill was included in the governor's proposal, and there's a lot of legislative attention, so it's likely, you know, that funding for that work will still be in play. The Hunter Ed bill was fully supported. The funding there to provide support to our Hunter Ed instructors as they do things like rent rooms or, you know, some of the relatively small costs that are incurred as they carry out Hunter Ed, that was supported. So very good news. Let me turn to capital budget. We requested $8.5 million new dollars in capital in the capital budget, but we received only $1.1 million. And you can see where that funding would go. It's to the Marble Mount Hatchery culverts. That's not as bad as it might sound. If you remember, two sessions ago, we got $65 million new dollars as part of the Jobs Now Act, where we're going out and putting that money on the ground and bringing on a lot of local contractors, so creating a lot of employment and improvement in the economy at the local level. And then last session, I think it was another $40 million or $45 million Jobs Now. So the fact that we didn't get the full $8.5 million wasn't a surprise to us. We got plenty to do, and it's a very positive picture on the capital side. So then let me put on my glasses, because the font's real small here, and I'm not going to go through this in a lot of detail, but there's a couple of interesting points I wanted to make as I look at, I'm looking at page 7 on the bottom, and I would just point out a couple of things here. If you look at about a third of the way down the page, the budget fund summary totals, officially we have now 1,489 FTEs funded. You see that number in the middle of the page, about a third of the way down? That is a little misleading, because actually I think you know that our staffing fluctuates by season. We have a lot of temps, a lot of seasonal workers. We also enter into contracts over the course of the year that aren't anticipated when they put these numbers together. So our actual staffing probably averages around 1,650 or so, and that fluctuates up and down, as I said. I mentioned earlier that, I wrote it in by hand, that our budget, our operating budget for this biennium is now up to $380 million. And then wanted to, especially for the new commissioners, I wanted you to see how complicated this budget is. As you go down the left-hand side, all of those numbers and then titles are the various accounts we manage in the operating budget. And they go over to the next page. And so you can see the large number of accounts we have. As you move across the page from left to right, you can see the fiscal year appropriation of those dollars in those accounts. The second to the last column on the right is the total of the first 2 years. And then you can see the percent of our total budget under the column percent share of rec sum. So lots of accounts. Of those, there are five that make up about 91% of our budget, and I wanted to point those out to you. The first is the first under the title Budget Fund Summary Totals. Fund 001-1 is our general fund state. So when I talk about general fund to you, this is the account that I'm referring to. For some of the commissioners that have been here for a while, if you look under the total, that total 6 years ago used to be $110 million. Now it's $63, making up about 16-17% of our budget. The next account right under that is our general fund federal. That's up at about $107 million, $108 million, and makes up about 28% of our budget. And then general fund local, funding from PUDs, funding from other entities across the state, we're at about $59 million, 15% of our budget. Those are three of the four biggest. If you keep moving down to O2R1, the Aquatic Lands Enhancement Account, there's an interesting story growing around this one. This is a relatively new account. I think we've received funding here for the last 3 or 4 years, but before that, we didn't have much there at all. This comes from GUI duck sales. It's an account that the Department of Natural Resources manages, and several agencies use it. It's grown for us, as I said earlier, now making up over 4% of our budget and $16 million. There's a problem here. I think you've heard in the papers about China and GUI duck sales. China consumes 92%, I believe, of the GUI ducks that we raise and sell. And these appropriations are made on a projection of sales. So the money's not in the bank. And issues with China aren't resolved soon, there are a number of agencies that are going to feel some serious hurt as a result of that. And you can see our dependence on that. That money goes into fisheries, into enforcement, into a number of areas. So we're watching that very closely. The last account I would point out is the about two-thirds of the way down the page, 104-1, our state wildlife account. At $104 million, everybody see that? And 27%, those are our license and permit fees. Very important account that the funding there has increased as a result of the permit fee increase 3 years ago, and also as a result of some increased participation over the last number of years in fishing license sales. So those five accounts make up 91% of our budget, and I wanted you to just see that and then see the context of the rest of our budget and all the various accounts that we manage. The following three or four pages give you specific descriptions about the various ads that were placed into the operating budget. And I won't go through them all, but if you're interested, you can see, for instance, on on page 9, as an example, the Bolt Legal Services, we received some additional funding for attorney costs related to the Culverts case. Towards the bottom of that page, we received some additional general fund to replace engines in the Partnavia in our airplane that's used for survey work, forest health assessments, law enforcement patrols, etc. You can see the fire suppression costs, etc. So you just get a sense of the description of how we should use those fundings when they were added to our budget. So with that, I'll stop. That's probably plenty. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to address those.
Great. I thought that was very clear. Any questions?
Then I had one other quick, if there's not one other quick topic. This has to do with the Tianaway land acquisition. I think you remember the legislature approved $99 million for 50,000-acre purchase of land in the Tianaway Valley just east of Cleellum, northeast of Cleellum. And the title is being held by the Department of Natural Resources, but through a conservation easement, we are co-managing that land. That partnership is going very well, I think. And that land is being placed into what's called a community forest trust. This was a state law that was passed 3 or 4 years ago and deals with the change of what's been past forest lands, commercial forest lands, and attempts to keep them out of development, attempts to keep them intact and working, preserving habitat, you know, striking that balance with a heavy influence by the community and how that land is managed. So we are, DNR and ourselves, are putting together a process that begins next Wednesday to develop to solicit and recruit an advisory committee of members from the community from across the state to help build a management plan for that land. The statute that passed requires that plan to be complete by June of 2015. So pretty aggressive. It's going to be a very complicated set of discussions, very time-consuming, and so we're looking for people to volunteer, like you do, to spend a lot of your personal time to help us put that plan together. And we have a kickoff at the Tianaway Grange on Wednesday evening from 6 to 8 to describe that. It'll be ourselves and some participation, I think, from the Kittitas County Commission, the Yakima Basin Integration Plan members, and the Department of Natural Resources, looking for people who are interested in helping us. So those were my two items.
Terrific. Any questions? I just wanted to signal my interest. I think the rest of the commission is interested too, continuing to be briefed on the $200,000 for hoof rot and where that's going to take us. I thought that was one of the more interesting dilemmas we've ever faced, one of the more difficult ones. What a perplexing problem. And I know that you've done tremendous work to try to track down the cause or to consider the options that we might have to respond to this management problem. So just keep us posted on that.
Will do.
Yeah. And I guess I just have to also say that I think one of the reasons that we were so successful, I've said this before, but one of the reasons we were so successful is because you've been picking the right thing, the right proposals to put forward. We've been modest. We've been frugal for years and years now. It's kind of discouraging to hear that the service costs are still going up. even though the budget's starting, I mean, the economic climate is starting to feel brighter in general. So we might get to that point where we're not suffering from the siege mentality anymore, but not quite there yet.
No, it'll be a while for the those costs to yeah. moderate. The medical side is slowing down. The slope's a little less, but it's still in a positive direction, and the education pressure is huge.
Yeah, and then there's the federal deficit reduction actions that we're going to have to share in the pain with. So we're not out of the woods yet, but it feels better. A little better.
A little bit.
Yeah. So thanks for that. Okay.